streets are screaming now. They brought Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about the U.S. economy, as promised. And let's start out with some news of the past week. A couple reports come out, conveniently, right before the debates and the election, saying, we haven't had this reported income, real income decline that everyone's been talking about for so long. Actually, last year, family incomes have risen. It was a private report. I forget the name of the research company, but it obviously was something that was contracted for and scheduled in time to come out right before the election. And then, of course, we have the second report, the census report on poverty in the U.S. this past week, right? Very convenient, right? In other words, it's a way of saying that, all this talk about those left behind in recovery is not quite true. They haven't really been left behind. And Mr. Trump, you know, all this talk about the middle class and working class down in the dumps here because of and discontented, that's just not true. Here's the data. Here are the reports. The U.S. economy is doing fine, and it's actually trickling down finally. You know, and even the ultra-liberal here, Paul Krugman, had a column today which nicely talked about Obama's trickle-up economics. Remarkably, median income rose 5%. The poverty rate substantially declined, and more people are covered by health insurance. As he says, a trifecta that we haven't hit since, 1999. Oh, best of all possible worlds. That's what the liberals are saying. Okay. By the way, just because I attack the liberals doesn't mean I'm a right-winger. Far from it. I attack them, too, because they're both wrong. They both got their head up you-know-where. Right? And they're cherry-picking the data that they want to make the political point that they're trying to push, right? But they're both wrong. Why are they wrong, right? Why is Mr. Krugman here really an ideologist for the center-left, just as we have ideologists on the center-right, and people are confused in between? Trickle-up economics, Paul, yes. Health insurance coverage covering more people. Poverty rate down and median family income up, right? And those who deny this, according to Paul, are liars, right? The 2009 Obama stimulus package, quote, expanded the social safety net, increased the purchasing power and demand of middle America. Well, you know, I guess Paul hasn't read his economic colleagues' latest update of IRS income data. I'm talking about Professor Emmanuel Saez of UC Berkeley, who has this ELSA database, it's called, of data he's been accumulating for over a decade now based on IRS and other global income sources that shows the wealthiest 1% households, in other words, those who have been enjoying the stock buybacks and the dividend payouts, in other words, the $1 trillion a year in combined buybacks and payouts, capital gains, for 5 consecutive years, and it looks like this is going to be the 6th consecutive year. $1 trillion a year distributed by their corporations to them, and of course with capital gains taxes and dividends taxes and carried interest taxes far below the normal tax rates, income tax rates, far below, these people get to keep the lion's share of all this. They get to keep it. And it's a combination of all these tax cuts and all these capital gains being pushed through the corporate tube down to the wealthy who own the stocks and bonds in this country, right, being pushed down through to them. No wonder 97% of all the net national income, GDP gains, right, since 2010, 97% of all the gross domestic product net generation, you know, everything above 0% GDP growth, there's a corresponding flip side of that, national income, and becomes disposable income. 97% of that has gone to this 1% households under Obama. Yeah, and that compares to 65%, whopping, under George Bush, and 48% under Bill Clinton. So it's accelerating. It's doubled since Bill Clinton under Barack Obama. And yet Krugman has the gall to say, oh, things are getting better for everybody. Well, a recent Gallup poll here in the past week showed that 30% of the American population, Gallup, a very respected poll, consider that the U.S. economy is doing poorly, and another 57% say it's getting worse. What's wrong here? Are people just not aware of the truth that Paul is explaining to them, that everything is much better than it was under Barack Obama here? Well, I'm going to dissect these numbers. I didn't have time this week. Dissect the numbers here next week for you on the census report. By the way, the census report never reports in increments of 1% or less. You know, the SIAS data reports not only the 1% wealthiest, but the 0.1% and the 0.01% of 1%. And within the 1%, it's concentrated even higher, into the tenths and 100s. It's the people at the very, very top who are even reaping this 1% benefit. Yes, it's them. Well, I'm going to dissect that for you next week, as well as this private report, you know. I mean, it's two coincidences. They released this stuff right before the election, and that's so, you know, the candidates can run around and trumpet. No pun intended there, trumpet. Okay. We'll see what's going on. You know, long-term, real income is still less today than it was in 1999. Still less. And less than it is even officially reported because they don't really adjust properly for inflation. Inflation's really higher than they're reporting. I mean, come on, you know, if you're a renter, right, do you think inflation is growing at only 1%? Per year here, or 1.5%? No. Right? If you live in cities and whatever, you've seen your rent go up 20-30%. Well, that takes a whack out of your spending income, doesn't it? Yes. Or if you're a student, a millennial, student debt and whatever, the cost of education keeps going up. There's a lot of things that keep going up. If you are in a working class, you're bearing the brunt of that, just as you bear the brunt of the decline in jobs and the decline in income, and real income in this case. So 1 year of alleged improvement in an election year of income for middle households, questionably, you know, we're going to look at the controverting data here by Sayers and the Gallup poll, what people really feel, really challenges this whole notion that everything is getting much better. There's another challenge to this notion, too. Actually, two more. One is, if you look at the polls, or the surveys, for those 25 to 64 in age in the workforce, right, death rates have almost doubled in the last 8 years or so for this particular group. Almost doubled. and is due to a more than doubling of deaths due to drug use, almost a doubling of deaths due to suicides, and chronic liver disease. In other words, people drinking and shooting up and doing themselves in, well, you know, in the 25 to 64 age group, that's a reflection of the desperation that's going on, and the standard of living that's collapsing. You know, you haven't seen anything like that since perhaps in the old, since the, you know, the Soviet Union, when it collapsed in the early 90s and went into a deep depression. We saw similar suicides and alcoholism and drug use and so forth, killing people, killing themselves out of desperation, you know. Well, that's going on in the U.S. maybe not quite as severe as there, but it's really a trend, and this is a real indicator of the depth and despair that's going on in certain segments of the population in the, in this country, and due to lack of jobs, right? And where jobs are being created, terrible jobs, low-paid, insecure, part-time, temp, gig jobs, right? That's what people have been getting here, except for a small sliver of folks, you know, in tech and so forth, right? Which used to be the norm, but now is the severe exception to the norm. The norm is poor-paying jobs with poor benefits, poor pay, high insecurity, right? And you just can't survive there. In that, you know, and a high number of in since 2008, high number of millennials having to live at home because they can't afford to rent on their low pay, half part time job, you know, hustling that they've got, many of them. So living at home, and it's really whacking those who have less than a 4-year education. You see, college education. Single-parent households for those without an education is 40%. 40% of households that have a single parent, right, are those without a college education. Okay, that's a huge number, right? If you don't have a college education and you're a single parent, you know, there's 40% of all the households are in that condition. Well, you try living on as a single parent with one or two or more kids. Try living on that kind of low pay, you know, $12 an hour, even 15. But most of it's, you know, in the worst states is less than 12. Right? Try living on that. It's impossible. Okay. So these reports, and Paul Krugman talk about the income growth, and they hype that up a little bit, you know. But the key is, again, segmenting that. You know, they talk, you know, these are national figures, and they talk as if everybody is benefiting similarly everywhere. Well, they're not. As I just said, if you're not four-year college education, you're much worse off. You know, the college-educated might be getting you know, token raises of 3-4%, but that means that the non-college educated, the working class, really the, you know, the core working class in this country, is doing poorly. Also, this income I predict you will see is concentrated in the big cities, metro areas. Right, so it's high. It's educated folks in the metro areas. Not in the key swing states that have benefited from this, you know, last year income growth that Paul Krugman is hyping. Now, this is critical for the election coming up because Trump is targeting this 25 to 64 age working class group in the swing states. I've talked about this before. And it's the swing states that are going to make the difference in the election. The swing states. What are the swing states? Ohio, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, maybe Virginia, Colorado, North Carolina. Okay, those are the swing states. And guess what? The big ones are Ohio and Florida. And guess what? Trump is ahead. No matter what gaffes or what he says, he's ahead in Ohio and Florida right now. And they haven't even started the debates. As I said before, this election is going to be determined by the outcome of the debates. You know, and I predict that Hillary's going to come out talking about rationally about numbers and so forth. Trump is going to come out not talking rationally. He's going to come out talking irrationally and telling people, are you better off or not better off? You know, the same old ploy that Reagan used in 1980. And people are emotional now. They're emotional about their condition. And throwing numbers at them about, you know, how much this and that you're going to improve the way, they're just upset. And whatever happens in the swing states is what's going to determine the election. And Hillary ought to be very nervous. It's not that I'm supporting Trump. Trump is a liar. Trump is a billionaire. How can you vote for a billionaire real estate manipulator who won't report his taxes, right? I mean, come on. Are you going to trust this guy? No. I don't trust him any more than I would trust Hillary. You know, they're both liars. Ah, but, you know, Trump is, his set of lies is appealing to people right now, particularly in the swing states, particularly if they're not college educated, particularly if they don't live in the big cities. And I'll tell you what, that's the majority. Yeah. Less educated. Let's not say they're uneducated. They're less educated, and they aren't deplorable. Wow, what an elite gaffe, right? For Hillary to say these are deplorables. Whoa, did she stick her foot in her mouth on that one? No, that's going to come back and haunt her. I mean, that's a Romney, right? That's in the same class as Mitt Romney saying the 47%. Remember that? Last election, the 47% are just, you know, free riders and taking everything from everybody else, from us rich folks, right? That was the end of Romney. Well, do you think that Donald Trump isn't going to mention deplorables in the debates? You betcha, you know? And incredible that a seasoned politician like her would make that kind of a gaffe. Yeah, well, they're not perfect. They can't cover up their elite prejudices everywhere and all the time. It slips through. And, you know, both of these people really have this kind of an attitude to the rest. You know, people are really not smart enough, they say, you know. They don't know the facts. You know, they can't handle their own affairs, let alone handle government affairs. We have to do it for them, you know, kind of noblesse oblige attitude by these elites. On both sides. There's no difference between them. We're going to be talking in coming weeks here, too. We're going to start dissecting their economic policies. What are they talking about? You know, Trump, of course, just came out talking about child care, right? Smart move, child care. Big factor, child care. Who's that aimed at? Oh, that's aimed at the college-educated middle class, right? Both of whom have to work and are paying big bucks for nannies. Okay, he's going to make it tax deductible. Whoa, that's a big appealing proposal, if it were true, of course. But that saves, that's an immediate income increase for that group of significant proportions. Child care. And, of course, Hillary had mentioned child care, too. But it just didn't get, it's kind of like a Hillary's progressive proposals are kind of always conditioned by exceptions. You know, they're like little forays into these areas. You know, forays into tax cuts, into child care, into college, free community college education, you know. I mean, she didn't come out and say, look, it should be free like Bernie did, right? Free, period. Oh, there's always, you know, she's hemming and hawing and chipping away at these issues, whereas Trump comes, whether he delivers or not, and he says, you know, take it all off your taxes, right? I mean, that's what appeals to people, because it's, you know, people aren't going to look into all the ramifications and details and so forth. Maybe, you know, maybe the Beltway people do that, but the rest of the country doesn't. That's a problem with a lot of Hillary's proposals. And, of course, Hillary has certain ghosts that she's carrying around with her that she just can't shake, which is a big problem. What are they? Well, the ghost of her husband, Bill Clinton, for one, and his policies on free trade. You know, first of all, you know, keep in mind, Hillary has not said, you know, let's not do the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's not do it. No. She said, I can't support it at this time, in its present form. Well, that's just a backhanded way of saying, well, I could support it. You know, make a token change. You were there, and I could support it, right? The token change is going to be these courts, right? We'll amend the court system, where corporations appoint their corporate lawyers to make rulings and then challenge governments elected by the people and negate the democracies and sovereignty of their own countries, right? That will be sort of amended, right? And that'll be good enough for Hillary. By the way, she may not even have to deal with this, you know, because there's a good chance once the election's over, some of these incumbents and those who lost their position will still be there until January 20th in Congress, I'm talking about. They'll be bought off, and their vote will be bought to push through the TPP. You know, I promise you a nice fat job with some consulting firm, you know. Boy, the corporations who want TPP will be bringing out their checkbooks, right, and writing checks to these guys who didn't get reelected, right? Didn't get reelected, so they're looking for another job. Right? They don't care anymore. You know, whoever come buy my last vote is what it'll be, and they will buy those last votes, and there's a good chance they'll push it through. So she will never have to deal with it, right? And she can say, well, you know, it was the last of Congress, not my fault. She or him, Trump, right? Because I don't believe Trump on free trade either. Trump is pandering to those people in those swing state working class folks that their jobs have been offshored here for decades now, and they're running around delivering pizzas, right? That's who he's pandering to. You know, they have a real issue. They have a real issue. But you can't trust him any more than you can trust her. I mean, will you vote for a billionaire or a multimillionaire? Which one, you know? The Clintons are worth over $200 million, right? And, of course, we don't know what Trump is worth, because he'll never show it. All the tax manipulations he's done. That would be the end of him if that ever became public. So he'll never reveal that, right, in the election. But you can't trust either of them. You can't trust people who are that wealthy not to take care of themselves and their wealthy friends, right? They'll throw a crumb or two when they can't afford to do so to the rest, but, you know, the lion's share of the benefits will go to them. That's the way that it's always been here in the last three decades, since Reagan in particular. Right. Okay, so watch out for the election. You know, Clinton's team here is reorienting themselves. They've finally become aware of the fact that, they're in deep doo-doo with the 25 to 64 age group and millennials, and they better do something. Right? They can't just play around with student debt or free college education for millennials or jobs, right? Or the fact that millennials can't afford, so many of them can't afford to live by themselves or living at home, or they're on Medicaid because they have low-paid jobs and they can't even afford to purchase Obamacare. Obamacare, that's another one we'll talk about. That's in deep trouble, too, here, beginning to unravel at the fringes here. We'll talk about that shortly, as I promised last week. But this whole healthcare thing, reports coming out now that the cost sharing for working class is rising under Obamacare, and all this talk about people on, you know, who jumped on Obamacare. Well, most of them jumped on high deductibles because they can't afford anything else. High deductibles, I mean, you know, like $1,000 to $5,000 deductible before the insurance even comes in. It's just like an emergency death insurance, you might say, dying insurance. And that's all they can afford, right? Those are the people who are, a lot of them who are signing up. And those who have signed up, you know, that's it. They're pretty much stuck. They're not going to get any more signups. And with the amount of signups they got on Obamacare, it cannot survive. It cannot survive because the health insurance company is saying they're not making enough money off of it because there's not enough customers. You know, they talked originally when this thing was being passed, $35 million. You know, they're not even at half of that. And that's all they're going to get. Okay, it's not financially sustainable at that amount of enrollment. Not sustainable. That's why you see some of these health insurance companies that are beginning to bail out of it, Aetna and others in different places. They're cherry-picking it. It's a hodgepodge, you know, and only some states will have it here after a few more years, I predict, effectively. Okay, and it hasn't controlled costs, you know. Insurance costs are going up everywhere. Why? Because the politicians are allowing the health insurance companies and the big pharma companies to engage in price gouging again. You know, in runaway price gouging for prescription drugs and so forth. And, you know, that price gouging is driving up the premium rates everywhere for everybody. Employer-provided health insurance, you know, jointly with employees and ACA and everything. It's making, and they're letting them do it. They're not doing anything. Just tokenism. Why? Because Big Pharma is, you know, biggest lobbyist sector of the economy. Spend more money than any other industry, more than oil companies, more than defense companies. Big Pharma, you know, that's why they get away with this. And we see repeatedly, you know, from the touring thing that I talked about months ago, you know, to the latest thing, this EpiPen thing, right? And now to diabetes. You know, a report came out, prisoners. There's an epidemic of hepatitis C in the prisons. Let's just take California. 17,000 prisoners in California? Hepatitis C? My God, hepatitis C. You know, it's an epidemic. Ah, but the states cannot afford to pay $80,000 for each of them for treatment. Politically, they can't, and financially, they can't afford to pay it. Well, that's because it's, you know, $1,000 a pill. Well, okay, so, you know, let the prisoners die. Including those poor schmucks who are in there because they smoked weed three times, right? So that's the reality. I mean, we're killing people. The pharma companies are killing people, literally killing. Far more people than, 9/11, you know, or wars we've been in, you know. Probably killed more people than, 56,000 lost during Vietnam, American personnel, right? Probably. I don't know the numbers. But they're murderers. The big pharma companies are murderers. And we're letting them get away with it. Politicians are letting them get away, and they won't touch them. You know, they do the token hearings here and there and so forth, but they won't touch them. They won't do anything about it. Why? Because it's a big check-writing lobbyist sector. That's why. All right, that's American politics for you, right? The best political system money can buy. If you got money, you got more votes. All right? Well, the Supreme Court even said so. Citizens United, free speech, money, spending money by corporations is free speech. After all, corporations are persons, right? They live forever. Strange persons. They got all the rights of persons, and, you know, they can't talk, but they talk with their bucks. So free speech, right? Let them spend as much as they want. Yeah. That's the Supreme Court. Yeah, for the people? Of the people? Yeah, sure. That's another fantasy. Fantasy. Okay, so to sum up here, Paul Krugman, you know, is as blind as ever. He's a shill for the Democrats, of course. That's why, right? Paul Krugman. He's not going to say anything. I mean, he unabashedly apologetic for Democrats and Obama and so forth, right? Unabashedly. And Obama, by the way, is another Hillary ghost. Clinton was a ghost. Obama is a ghost because Hillary is carrying the burden of the failure of the Obama recovery. That's the ghost on her other shoulder, you know. Free trade and hubby Bill, that's the ghost on the other. No one believes her when she talks about free trade. She's going to can't support TPP in its present form. Hasn't said anything really about doing anything about NAFTA. Oh, and this past week we had another piece of news about NAFTA. You know, Ford Motor Company is moving all its small auto production and assembly to Mexico. Goodbye, auto workers. More jobs. Gone, gone, going, 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 gone. You know, there won't be any auto union left. Oh, they'll represent grad students at the universities, right? That's how desperate they've been organizing grad students at universities. You know, the great United Auto Workers Union that led the country, you know, during the Depression in World War II and after, and propelled so many families into middle-class incomes, you know, pioneered and pushed employer-provided health care and pensions along with the mine workers and steel workers. Yeah, that great tradition collapsed. You know, under the neoliberal assault in the 70s and 80s, 90s, unions are just a shell of what they were in this country. And that's why wages can't rise. You know, usually before, unions used to drive up the wages, right? Wages went down during the recessions, and then the unions recouped it after the recessions in collective bargaining. Well, that hasn't happened for a couple decades now because the unions have been destroyed and collective bargaining has been circumscribed and undermined. Right? Have you heard of any big strikes here in the last decade? No. They're so weak they can't strike. All they can do is come to the table with hat in hand and say, please give us something. And management says, nah, you know, you're okay. You're not desperate enough yet. And because wages aren't being raised as a result of union bargaining effect, union wage differential, right, and benefits, of course, as well, they have to raise minimum wages now, right? No other source is raising wages. So they raise minimum wages, but, you know, that's only like 10 million of a 157 million workforce benefits from that. And maybe the tier right above that, another 10 million. So maybe 20 million. And it's only being done state by state, not nationally. So, you know, East and West Coast, where you have more civilized policies, social policies left still in some cases, you find a minimum wage increase statewide. But the rest of the country, in various places, the South and so forth, no, I think we'll leave them at desperate, you know, $7.50 an hour levels. And people are desperate, you know, in those places, which include the swing states, right? Yes. Okay. Hillary's ghost. I'll be writing about that for Telesur. Telesur is this media outlet in Latin America that I write for twice a month, articles. And I'll be posting on my on my blog. So those interested in read my print versions of some of these discussions here on the show, jackrasmus.com. That's my blog. You can go there and read a lot of these articles that are posted. And by the way, you can go to my website, which is just Google jackrasmusproductions.com, and it'll say Kikalas Productions, which is the renamed business website that I have, and you'll be able to view my various interviews, video and audio interviews there at that time on the website as well for free, right? The blog's for free and the website's for free, so take a look. Take a look in some of the more in-depth analyses. But I'll be writing and talking more about the election here, right? I got two things in mind. One, you know, fleshing out this idea of Hillary's ghosts before she goes into the election. I mean, the debates here, right? And the other topic I'm going to focus on this coming month is taming Trump. Well, what does that mean? He doesn't sound like he's very tamed, is he? When I say taming, taming by who? Well, the Republican establishment, you know. They've come to a kind of an uneasy agreement on how to proceed until the election here. And taming means Trump is adopting traditional Republican positions on tax cuts for business investors and so forth, you know, these traditional positions. And he's backtracking on some of his positions on trade and so forth. In other words, he's moderating his income positions here, income for the rich positions, more in line with the establishment, Republican establishment. At the same time, because he's doing that, he's becoming more aggressive on non-economic issues, these social issues, you know, like his speech down there in Arizona, right? In Mexico, you know, on immigration. So he's going to be more aggressive and radical on the non-issues to offset his accommodations on the economic issues. So Trump is being tamed in part by the Republican establishment as part of a modus operandi, or whatever you want to call it, here in the election period, right? So taming Trump and Hillary's ghosts will be the themes going forward here, and we'll do a thorough analysis of their economic positions on various issues, you know, taxes, trade, child care, et cetera. Although I caution everybody, you know, it probably doesn't mean very much because they just say what they think the population wants to hear, and then they go do what they want anyway. That's why it's not going to make a hell of a lot of difference whoever gets elected once again. Right? So we'll watch this very carefully unfold. Their positions and their strategies, and you know, with Trump ahead in the swing states, what is Hillary going to do? And of course, we'll comment on the debate in detail when it occurs. Our show right after the debates, which come up in 11 days, I think, will be dedicated totally to the debate and an analysis of it. You know, in the context as of today is, despite these reports, these Pollyanna reports, oh, that everything's doing good and better, you know, despite them, which you look at all the other evidence and people aren't, and the fact that Trump is ahead in these key states now already, that will be the context. We'll keep looking at that as we look at the positions of the two candidates as they near the finish line here. And looking behind all that is the state of the U.S. economy. Now, in recent months, I have predicted, and I stand by the prediction, that the U.S. will enter recession in 2017-18. look what's already happening. The economy should be booming in these months right before the election. It always had in the past, as government pumped up the economy and the politicians pumped up the economy to make it look like it was good so they could help themselves get elected, right? That's not even happening this time. You know, we're in the, seventh year since the, quote, official end of the recession. Seventh year. Wow. And that's about the average of recession or recovery periods. And this has been the weakest recovery ever, and no recovery for those, you know, at the median and below. No recovery. Right? Recovery, yes, for corporations. Recovery, yes, for investors. Recovery, yes, for maybe the top 5% households. But everyone else is sort of stagnating or going backwards. Still, you know, regardless of these reports, right, when you segment them and look below, right, well, maybe highly educated people in the big cities, you know, got an income boost and you average it out, right? But it's the averaging out and look at other segments of the population, not in the big cities, not college education, and they're going backwards, right? And they're desperate. And they're getting increasingly desperate. And when you're desperate, you know, you want someone on a white horse to ride in and shake it up. That's all you want. Now, don't tell me about your promises and your programs, because I'm not going to listen to them. I don't care about the details. Just give it back to those SOBs that gave it to me. That's the mental state of many people. Right? And you can read it in the surveys. You know, people say, yeah, I don't agree with Trump on immigration, you know, but he's going to shake it up. There, I'm going to vote for him because he's going to shake him up. Right? That's where a lot are coming from, 25, 64, and the millennials. And we'll see what Hillary does, because she's supposedly coming out with some new policies and proposals here targeting these two groups that she's way behind on, two groups that are key to her winning the swing states, you know, without which she won't, right? She should have just appointed as a running mate Bernie Sanders. You know, she would then have the millennials. You know, but the party hacks in the Democratic Party would not have that. You know, so she couldn't make the smart move. She had to pick this guy. Who the hell is Kane? Right? Oh, he's a governor. You know, he was a free trader. Right? That's Kane. That's all we know about him. You know, Mr. Nobody. But, you know, that's what the party leaders wanted, and that's what they got. All right, so now she has a big uphill with the millennials who won't vote for her. And, of course, she has uphill 2564, and she keeps calling them deplorables, not smart. Okay, but in the backdrop to all this is the U.S. Economy and the condition. And I stand by my prediction that I provided here, have been for several months. Why? Well, just look last month. That's my last prediction statement here. Last month, what happened? Oh, manufacturing. Manufacturing over the past year is flat to negative. Services are slowing fast. The growth in services is slowing fast. Construction, commercial construction is flat. Residential construction, you know, you got some apartments, right? Foreign demand for high-end houses, refis, people rushing to refinance before interest rates go up in December, which they will. All right. Discretionary, all forms of discretionary consumer household spending, down, negative. Retail sales came out this week, negative 0.3% in August. Auto sales clearly have peaked over the summer and now are slowing and on their way down. Department stores, the same. Online spending, the same. Declining, slowing. You know, so you can't make the argument, oh, people aren't going to department stores, they're buying stuff online. No, both are down. Okay? jobs data for the last several months, very weak. You know, we had almost a collapse of jobs data, and then we had, a surge here last month. But below the surface, as I talked about previously, the numbers are poor for jobs, job creation. In other words, we're seeing a churning in the jobs number here, which is a preliminary to a weakening of the jobs. Job creation always lags 6 months, the bigger crisis. So, next year, watch for jobs, particularly in the first quarter next year, to be very poor. GDP, gross domestic product of the U.S. in the first half of 16, as I've talked about last week, 0.7%. That's it. When you back out the phony redefinitions of GDP, 0.7%, that's almost stagnation in a period here before an election year when it should be booming more than anything else. It should be 3.5% normally. I predict they're going to have very poor Christmas sales season this year. And you could have a very negative economic effect from the election. Just imagine people are going to be, if Trump gets elected, people are going to be shocked, and they're going to assume the worst, and they're going to pull in their spending arms, consumers. Consumers are the only ones that have kept this thing going for the past year, and now auto has collapsed, and department stores and online are collapsing, retail sales are down. Okay, so that's the end, the beginning of the end of the consumer. On the business side, industrial production, mining, manufacturing, utilities is negative. Business inventories are flat. Businesses aren't investing, accumulating inventories. So business spending, real net total domestic product, 2% growth here? Normal is, somewhere between 5 and 10%, 2% and heading south. Every indicator now, they can't even hold up consumption, is flashing red on the U.S. economy. Every indicator. And that's before the Fed raises rates. And it is going to raise rates, no doubt about it. Question is just whether it's before December or in December. And once it does, it's going to have such a psychological effect. Even if it's just a small quarter percent, the federal funds rate, even that, it's going to have such a psychological effect on investment right after an election, which is also a period of great uncertainty, particularly with these two candidates, either one. Right? Raising the interest rates, again, a big whack to autos and construction, residential construction, psychological impact, and business investment. Right? So you're going to see a very unstable situation between November and January this year economically. I think the economy will take a big step towards this recession. It may not emerge immediately in the first quarter of next year because, the new Congress will immediately abandon this fiscal austerity position it's had since 2011. And we will see, I predict, again, another predicting, fiscal stimulus package involving infrastructure spending by the government. And in other words, the Republican hold on the House, Republicans will compromise and will agree to infrastructure stimulus, fiscal stimulus, which will give a brief period of of investment confidence. So you will see some spending going on here on the business side, briefly, reflecting the government plan to infrastructure. But infrastructure stimulus will be moderate, the token, and it will be long-term. So its immediate effect on the economy will have some positive financial effect, but not an immediate real effect. That will be intermediate at best. But in order to agree to the infrastructure spending, because conservatives, pro-business lobbyists who dominate Congress will demand, and they will get corporate tax cuts, investor tax cuts again. You see, under George Bush, we gave them $3.4 trillion. And Obama comes in the first 2 years, he extends the Bush tax cuts. That's another $450 billion, plus $300 billion in his stimulus program. So the first 2 years, he increases business investor tax cuts to $750 billion after George did $3.4 trillion. And then we have all this thing about the fiscal cliff. Remember that one? Yeah, so Obama agrees to extend for the Bush tax cuts for another 10 years at the end of 2012, so starting in 2013 when fiscal cliff goes into effect, right? We have another $4 trillion. So we have, you know, somewhere about $9.5-10 trillion since George Bush and Obama came to office of business tax cuts, and that's not enough. And they're going to give them more? Yeah, you're going to give them more. So watch for that right after in the lame duck Congress. You know, it might spill over into the next 2017 Congress to make all that happen by March. But you're going to see a stimulus, fiscal stimulus, infrastructure stimulus in exchange for business investor tax cuts. And they'll tell us once again, oh, tax cuts create jobs, for which there's absolutely no evidence. Just the opposite. You give corporations tax cuts, what do they do with it? Do they reinvest it in jobs in America? No. They send it offshore. Right? They invest offshore. Or they invest now in financial assets, securities that don't create any jobs because most of these big businesses are really shadow banks themselves. You know, a third of their profits come from financial portfolio investment. They're bankers. Shadow bankers, right? In my book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, I dedicate several chapters to that, showing how, you know, quantitatively as well qualitatively, we have this shift to financial asset investing going on, which is slowing real investment in real goods and services that create real jobs and real income for real people. That's being diverted, you see, to financial speculation and financial investment. Right. And that's one reason why the economy just can't grow, and real investment has been declining, you know, steadily for over a decade now. Okay, so, you know, you can if you want to read that, chapter 11, 12, 13 of my book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, published earlier this year, go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, click on that. It'll take you to my website, and you can read some free chapters. Get a sense of what's going on. Okay. And you can get, you know, go on my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can read about how that view, financial view of the global economy, is translated in the case study of an emerging new financial imperialism, I declare, which is emerging in the periphery of Europe, Greece. My most recent book this month, Looting Greece. A new financial imperialism emerges. All right, so from financialization of the global economy and the instability and the problems it's been causing to a form of financial imperialism, an extension of that in the most recent book. And next year, my next book coming out will be Central Bankers on the Ropes. In other words, how central bank policies, QE, negative rates, all that nonsense is will lead to the next depression. Okay, by the way, those books are a discount. A discount. You can get 20% off the Amazon price for Looting Greece through PayPal from my website and blog. And you can get a 33% off for Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy off the Amazon list price at $20, also through PayPal. Okay, enough plug of the book. All right, so post-election. We talked about what's going to happen post-election already here, to some extent, tax cuts for infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned TPP will likely be ramrodded through at that time. Mm-hmm. Corporate tax cuts, you know, we justified, we got to defend Apple, you know, the company Apple Computer, or Apple, here, because the European Union is attacking Apple and saying, Apple, you know, you haven't even paid 2% taxes here in Europe, hiding away in your Irish tax havens, you know, and the European Union chastised Ireland for doing that as well, and great political upheaval now going on in Ireland, fiscal and tax policy and so forth. You know, it's a big tax shelter, Ireland. Companies locate their headquarters there. You know, they report their profits through Ireland, which is, you know, super low taxes, and they don't have to pay taxes on Uncle Sam. You know, Apple's sitting on $200 billion of cash, and 90% of that's offshore, keeping it there. And what they'll do is say, oh, we'll bring some of it back. We'll repatriate some of it if you, Congress, reduce the tax rate. Then we'll bring some back. Well, they pulled that deal off in 2005 once before under George Bush, you know. They said, oh, big corporations, Apple, and those said, we'll bring the money back if you lower the tax rate from 35% to 5.25%, which we did. And they brought, you know, about $700 billion back. Part of the deal was they're supposed to invest in jobs in the U.S. They didn't. They used the money to buy competitors, you see, and to pay back dividends. That's what they use the money for. And they're running that same ploy. You know, there's been bills in Congress that say, oh, well, you know, we'll lower your rate to 10% if you bring some of the money back, please. So that will be part of this whole tax deal that they're putting together. It'll be justified that, we got to protect Apple, our company, you know, from the Europeans who want to tax Apple. Yeah, Apple, our company, you know. 111,000 Apple employees, where do they exist? They exist in Foxconn in China. It's not a U.S. company. All right, so we'll be talking about these themes, the election positions of the candidates, and the debates coming up, and the U.S. economy, all in the coming weeks. This is Alternative Visions. Jack Rasmus.